Any successful chef keeps an eye on the numbers. He's got to make sure that enough people enjoy their food, right? So anyone who's too focused on his own vision and not what other people want is usually a disaster.
And you normally promise your chefs you'll give equity. And with Rishi, you said, once you hit your numbers because it wasn't profitable, I will give you a share. But you gave him more than he expected, and he was thrilled with that. Were you already clear of that number?
Not always, but I think I try and make sure I align my interests with the chefs. Because, look, at the end of the day, I recognize they have to look after themselves. They have no one else in the world will look after them if they don't look after themselves. So if I can align my interests with them and they can look after themselves, they'll look after me. That's how I always look at this shareholding thing. Look, and chefs are very mobile, right? The talent is very mobile. If you don't look after them, if they find a better opportunity somewhere else, they'll walk. And in their shoes, I would walk. They don't owe me a living. So I try and make sure my interests are aligned with them. That's the thing I know will succeed in the long term for both parties.
Hey Simis, welcome to episode 140, part 2 of the So This My Why podcast. I'm your host and producer, Lingya, and today we are back for part 2 with Lolik Peng, the CEO and founder of Unlisted Collection, where he shares a lot more about his process of going from being a lawyer to hotelier. In this particular episode, we dive straight into the intricacies of his business. For instance, we talk about things like, why does he give equity to his head chefs? How does he identify and convince talents like award-winning Michelin-starred chef Rishi Nalindra to come on board? How does he work together with the chefs to ensure that they have everything they need to build a thriving business? How has he seen winning Michelin stars impact the chefs he works with? Brand building, knowing when to pull the plug, because guess what? He's also had big failures too, including a painful one with One Leicester Square in London, his big passion with museums, and so much more. Now, if you haven't already heard his origin story, I would advise to head over to the previous part one episode first. But if you've already listened to that, then do stick around because we are about to kick off with part two of the So This My Why episode with Lolik Peng. And by the way, this was recorded in the studio. So if you want to actually watch it, you can. Just head over to YouTube, look up So This My Why and find Lolik Peng's episode. Now, are you ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the So This Is My Why podcast, where we talk to people about their whys and how they turn them into realities to inspire you to live your best life. And here's your host, Ling Ya.
I love that you brought up hands off, because that is very much your trademark. It applies to your restaurants, it also applies to your hotels. And I wonder, was it very clear from the start this is your approach, or was it very much because at the time when you first started your hotel, you thought, I'm going to go back to law anyway, I need someone to take over, therefore find someone?
I think it was by necessity, actually, more than anything else, simply because of the breadth of the kind of things we do. If I tried to be hands-on with all the hotels and restaurants that I did, it would be unmanageable. Because we have hotels and restaurants in too many jurisdictions, and we have too many types of restaurants, too many types of hotels, all different time zones, and you can't be everywhere at once, right? And the thing about hotel is a 24/7 operation. There's a decision to be made every minute of the day, and if you were trying to be too hands-on, it just would be unmanageable. Either that or you would have nothing else to do in your life, but I have a family and things like that. So I tend to be more set certain goals, and obviously the certain decisions still have to come back to me, whether or not it's major investments, whether it's things to do with the legal side of things to make sure that we comply with regulations, things that always come back to me. But other than that, you know, I try and leave the commercial decisions to my managers and try and make sure that they have enough interest in the success of the property that they look at it as their own thing as well, right? And I try not to manage day to day. It's a fool's errand.
An example I want to bring as chef, Rishi Nalindra. He has worked with you for a very, very long time. You first found him because you dined at his restaurant, Maka, and you realized that, oh, it's really empty, but his food's really good.
Yeah.
And then he came and had a 10-minute conversation, in which case you said, you come back next Monday and tell me whether you want to go ahead or not.
Yeah.
You must have had a very clear mind beyond just eating the food that this is someone you wanted.
What I've realized over the years, I think I'm a pretty good spotter of talent when it comes to F&B. I tend to have a fairly good ability to pick the winners in terms of the F&B guys. the guys who I think have potential. So I think Rishi was one of them. Yeah, I went to eat in his restaurant. Instinctively, I knew he could cook really well, and his food was... Well, I couldn't put a finger on it. It was Australian cuisine, or he called it Australian cuisine. But at the same time, it wasn't, right? It wasn't conventional. Anyway, that word Australian cuisine is a bit of a misnomer, because there is no such thing as Australian cuisine, really, right? It's really just a fusion of many things. So I was a bit sort of taken aback. I was like, wow, this guy is a huge talent, but he's in this weird restaurant. Nobody knows he's here. No marketing, nothing. A friend brought me there, actually, and I was like, what is this guy doing here? So I just said to him, hey, if you ever want to have a chat, come and see me, you know. And sure enough, opportunity came that we could work together. And I said to him, this is my style of working. I'm not going to be calling shots, but I hope I build an environment around you that allows you to succeed. And that's really how it happened.
Yeah. So was there any kind of duty that you did? Because I listened to some of his interviews and I could immediately sense, oh, this is why I would work with someone like him. Because he's very much the, why would you take a gap year? You just got to go straight to work. And he's very much focused on perfecting his craft, which I imagine you need to succeed.
Yes.
But did you do all that research before to know who he
was? No, I didn't do any research on him.
Wow.
All I knew was this guy from Australia, Sri Lankan background, could cook very well. And it seemed to me like he was in the wrong place.
Mm.
That was my only impression. So I kind of figured that, okay, given the right environment and the right sort of thing, he could really succeed. Yeah. And sure enough, he got his Michelin star within 6 months or something.
But you couldn't have known that before.
No, I had no idea. And our ambition was not to get a Michelin star. Our ambition was to open a cool little brasserie-type restaurant with lots of lovely kind of flavors, but not too expensive. That was our only ambition, and kind of nice wines.
But just opening that little brasserie is really difficult. And Rishi himself said, I had no idea what it took to launch a restaurant or put together a team.
Yeah, so we helped them through that bit, right? We are good at building that infrastructure around them.
What does that look like?
Means making sure that you're someone to look after accounts, HR, purchasing, the licensing, the regulatory things, and making sure there's prudence around the business model. And then just saying to him, you cook what you want to cook. Don't blow your budget on the food costs. Don't blow your budget on labor costs. And we'll walk them through that, right?
Yeah.
And then the rest of it, we leave up to them. So the creative part of it is the secret sauce. You got to produce the dishes that we want. And he was busy from day one. He was packed from day one. People came in droves, you know. And Boon Tat Street was a little bit sort of slightly sleepy in those days. But his restaurant was, I would say, successful from day one, more or less.
Because of the marketing? I mean, no one had heard of him before.
Marketing and word of mouth. I think no one had heard of him because I think he was in Tangling, that old post office, right, in the basement. And so there's no hope for lunch there because it's nowhere near the CBD, you know. And dinners, you get a little bit of dinners at weekends. The location didn't work for the kind of food he was doing. I instinctively knew that. So I think that was more me putting him in the right place and letting him express his own talent. Yeah, it wasn't necessarily PR or marketing. I don't think we did any PR, in fact. We might have had some internal marketing, but I don't think we did a lot of PR or anything special for him. Yeah.
Something he said once in an interview I thought really funny. He said, I didn't understand what P&L was before. If I knew, I would have never said yes. And Ping knows the whole story. So what is the whole story?
Well, P&L is important, right? Look, I've had many conversations with Chef, and if they kind of go on just only about artistic vision without any sense of what a restaurant needs to succeed, and you have no sense of the P&L, then you're not going to succeed no matter how artistic your food is. So I think the first thing I always talk to my chefs is we draw a business plan, we do a projected P&L, and we got to try and meet that, right? There's no restaurant where you can just artistic expression or whatever it is you want to call it. End of the day, somebody's got to like your food enough to pay you for it.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point you cooking what you like if nobody else likes it, and you are doomed.
Yeah, Heston Blumenthal definitely keeps an eye on the numbers for sure.
Any successful chef keeps an eye on the numbers. He's got to make sure that enough people enjoy their food, right? So anyone who's too focused on his own vision and not what other people want is usually a disaster.
And you normally promise your chefs you'll give equity. And with Rishi, you said, once you hit your numbers because it wasn't profitable, I will give you a share.
Mm.
But you gave him more than he expected, and he was thrilled with that.
Mm.
Were you already clear of that number?
Not always, but I think I try and make sure I align my interests with the chefs. Because, look, at the end, I recognize they have to look after themselves. They have no one else in the world will look after them if they don't look after themselves. So if I can align my interests with them and they can look after themselves, they'll look after me. That's how I always look at this shareholding thing. Look, and chef are very mobile, right? The talent is very mobile. If you don't look after them, if they find a better opportunity somewhere else, they'll walk. And in their shoes, I would walk. They don't owe me a living. So I try and make sure my interests are aligned with them. That's the thing I know will succeed in the long term for both parties.
And you mentioned the Michelin star. When Rishi got it, you said you saw a switch flip in him. What was that?
I think he never realized he was capable of getting a star. I would say, you know, a lot of people have this imposter syndrome, right? They look up to people and more successful peers that they have. Sometimes when you are an ethnic minority in a place like Australia, you don't always think that you are the equal of the peers that you go to cooking school with or you cook in your kitchens.
Yeah, for context, he's Sri Lankan.
Things like that. Yeah, for context, he's a Sri Lankan background, right? And you see that in the UK too. It always seems a little bit harder for you to achieve something. So I think maybe he just never thought he'd get a Michelin star. And I kind of always knew he was capable of it in a way. We didn't aim for it, but I knew this guy could cook, right? And he had a very unique flavor. He wasn't cooking what anyone else was cooking at that. Remember, he had a laksa leaf ice cream that blew me away. Chili, in fact, green chili and laksa leaf ice cream. I was like, wow, this thing is super tasty, but nobody would have thought of doing a green chili ice cream. He was doing really unique things, and I knew there was something about him.
You said something else once in relation to another chef, Sam Miller. There comes a time in the chef's career when you know he's ready to strike out on his own, and then you reach out to them. What is that timing?
I think chefs who have occupied senior positions for a certain number of years, who have enough experience and who recognize their own talents and have enough ambitions to come out on their own. That's a fairly delicate sort of exercise, right, to understand when that period might be. So it's more sort of looking for that tipping point in their careers. Not always easy to spot. But in some people, you know, because you've encountered them enough, you've seen them at work enough, you've seen the things they produce and the chefs that have come through. And then you know, okay, the next step is to do their own thing. There's nowhere else for them to go.
Yeah. There's one thing you said earlier in relation to Stanley, that you focus on the branding. And I think that's very interesting because unlike most hospitality businesses, everything is so distinct. When I show most people, oh, this is the list under Unlisted Collection, they will go, it's all under one company? I had no idea because they're so distinct. So it's not like another organization where you just carry through the goodwill of one brand to another to another. How do you think about brand building then?
I never thought about brand building as a singular kind of thing.
Yeah.
I was always more interested in building a particular property, a particular hotel, a particular restaurant. So we never had a common brand that we tried to propagate beyond one property.
Do you not think it's easier? Because another person I'm interviewing is Arthur Keong of Far East, and they would, once you go to one hotel, you know what the other hotel would look like. Wouldn't that be easier?
No. In my mind, yes, but it would not work for the things we do, right? Because our hotels are very individual. They just exist as one. Eau Claire, I couldn't do another Eau Claire anywhere else because the Eau Claire was literally the Claire Hotel that was in Chippendale. Sure, I could give it a brand sort of like Unlisted Eau Claire or Unlisted Town Hall, but you know what? All of them are so different that it's meaningless to do it that way. We didn't ever set out to have a brand standard and we don't. So could we do it? Probably, but I'm not particularly interested in it. It wouldn't be much fun in my book, so I'm just not interested in doing it.
Yeah. There's one part briefly, and this was in relation to all the difficult times that you had with your properties, and you said that you do go through those blind panic moments, but they're actually good for you when you get through them. A lot of people do go through those moments as well. So what would your advice be in just getting through those moments?
What I recognize now is those moments of insecurity are your own intellect telling you not to get complacent. So those moments are good. You need to panic, you need to have fear, you need to really focus hard on what's going to make you succeed, because the minute you think it's going to be easy and you get a bit complacent, you're probably going to fall flat in your face. So I appreciate now the moments of great stress, the moments when you are a little bit panicky and you're, you know, like, oh my gosh, this is all going wrong, this kind of thing, because it really sharpens what you do. I've learned to not necessarily embrace, but to appreciate that those moments have a reason why they come. So I would say no one should ever feel that success comes easy or a project is easy, right? So it's good to have those moments when you are a little bit sort of panicking, a little bit sort of feel a little bit out of your depth. That's when you produce your best work, because you're not complacent, right? You're thinking hard about what you need to do to make the project work.
But don't you have in your mind, if it reaches a certain point, I've got to pull the plug. Like Sorel, for instance, you pull
yes,
the plug on that.
Yes, yes. I think you have to have those. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you need to have enough clarity. And that comes sometimes with experience too.
Mm. Yeah. So what is the requirements or factors that you take into account when you say, enough, we need to let this go?
I think it really depends, you know, there's no one answer. I mean, I have let go of projects before, and sometimes you run out of ideas for them. Other times you just realize that whatever you put together here is not working. As I said, enough of the public has to want to appreciate what you're doing, that for it to commercially succeed. If you're just doing it because you think it's going to succeed, and so far nobody else thinks it's going to succeed, then you're not going to make a success of it.
Yeah. What would you say is your biggest failure?
Biggest failure? I would say the one that taught me the most lessons was One Leicester Square. So I did this hotel in London that was the former St. John's, the very iconic restaurant, and they opened a hotel on Leicester Square. And anyone of you who knows Leicester Square, it's the opposite of Bethnal Green. It's packed with tourists.
Perfect.
It's probably the busiest place in London, right?
Chinatown's
there. Everything is there. You got the theatre district, and it's rammed. It's like literally tens of thousands of people walking past an hour. So I thought, wow. I knew it had gone on kind of liquidation through the grapevine. And I spoke to my lawyers, okay, let's make a bid for this property. In my mind, it was nothing could go wrong, right? It was such a busy location. So I bought over the property, converted it, you know, did some renovation to the hotel room. The hotel rooms were beautiful. They didn't get much room. Changed the restaurant. Within 3 months, got a Michelin star. And I was like, okay, we're on the way. This is really good. And nobody came. And I was like puzzled. I was like, there's thousands of people walking past you. Why are they not eating with us? You know, we got a Michelin star. We got its great reviews, fantastic reviews. All the reviewers loved the food. And then I realized that everyone walking past was on the way to Chinatown. They're all there for sewing up. They don't give a damn about my Michelin star restaurant. And so in the end, I had to sell it tail between my legs. So it taught me a lesson that just because there's traffic there doesn't mean that you're able to capture the traffic. I didn't do any due diligence on that project because in my own mind, so busy, I just do a good restaurant, people will come. And they didn't come, despite walking right past the restaurant. It was a painful lesson, but a very, really valuable one about knowing your market. Just because you do a restaurant with great reviews does not mean people will come. You still have to be attracting the right people, the right traffic there. And most English people don't go to Leicester Square because it's full of tourists.
Yes,
you never. Know?
Or Oxford Street.
So if you're a local there, you're not coming to this restaurant because you don't want to fight for space with tourists. If you're a tourist, you're going to Chinatown to eat siung up and wonton mee. You're not going to come and eat my Michelin star food, right? It's not why they come to Leicester Square. And on occasions when they had this big movie debuts and things like that, the whole square is closed. Anyway, it was the wrong crowd. Busy as it was the wrong crowd.
Another thing about Leicester Square is that it's very close to other big museums. Mm. And that is also another big passion of yours.
Mm.
How did that come about?
How did that come about? I've always loved museums, I think. I was always someone who went to exhibitions. So I've always had a little bit of a thing for old buildings, maybe. Old artifacts,
collecting
antiques and kind of antiquities. I did classics in school. So I always had this thing about the Greek classics, the kind of Roman classics, things like that. Funnily enough, not enough Asian things when I was younger. And when I first came back to Singapore, museums in Singapore weren't really cutting edge. They weren't terrible, but they were not cutting edge. And there was not maybe as good a focus on collections and on exhibitions, on doing different type of shows. So I used to go overseas more to kind of do museums.
Well, it's one thing to appreciate and to attend museums, now to be the chairperson of the Asian Civilization Museum, the Peranakan Museum, and see what it actually takes to run these museums.
Mm.
So what is it behind the scenes that we generally don't see?
I think what people don't realize about museums is how much, I guess, work goes on behind the scenes, right? Because for every exhibition you see, you know, it's probably taken hundreds of thousands, if not millions, and hundreds of man hours to put that show on. And a lot of it is international collaboration. You borrow from other institutions. There's a lot of academic work that goes into the kind of displays, the exhibitions. There's a lot of things that goes into the catalogue for the shows, and many, many negotiations with different museums to bring different collections in.
And verifying whether it's even authentic or there.
Yeah.
The big hoo-ha with British Museum.
Yes. I mean, there's a huge amount of controversy now about provenance, about authenticity, also about looted artworks, right? And of course, all the big institutions have have this rather questionable collections, right? I don't want to call them illegal. In most instances, by their laws, they're legal. But, you know, it's usually stolen from someone. That's the reality, yeah. Or yeah. Taken in fairly dodgy circumstances. We don't have that much of a problem here in Singapore because we were never a colonial power. So if we have a problem with our collection, it's usually because of provenance, right? You unknowingly collect something that was looted from a gravesite, things like that, typically. But the other major museums have all these issues of whether their collections should really be with them or return to the place where they were looted from.
Hey Simis, if you haven't done so already, please do head over to give a rating and review for this podcast, because without it, Apple Podcasts, Spotify will never push it forward to let anyone else see. So just head over, share with people, that people will know about this special series, especially the ones that we are showcasing right now on Singaporeans who have achieved incredible success. And just before we go to questions from other people, I wonder, you have been interviewed a lot, you've been featured for a very, very long time. Any question you wish people would just ask you?
No, actually, no. I'm not in the least bit.
Less questions the better.
Not just that. I'm not sure that anything I say is particularly interesting, right? I think I get asked a lot of questions. To me, I think my answers are rather banal, but, you know, sometimes people find them interesting, which always surprises me.
Yeah, people find them interesting. There are several questions. And the first one was really, do you still identify as a lawyer?
No, because now I don't think I would be competent at all. I would get in a lot of trouble if I tried to practice law.
And there was a lot of interest around the fact that you were an ex-lawyer and then you pivoted. So there was this question from Krishna Kumar who said, which pivot was the easiest, which was the hardest and why?
You know, pivoting from law at the time was not difficult because I always intended to go back. And in those days, it seemed like an unusual choice. But nowadays it's not, right? Mm. People don't blink an eye when people change professions, you know? You spend all these years training to be a lawyer, whatever it is. Now it's so common. It's no longer that surprising when people do it, whether it's doctors becoming chefs or businessmen or things like that. People realize now that you can have a multitude of careers throughout your life. And frankly, there are enough lawyers.
Yes, they are.
So it's not, there'll be no loss to the world if you went from being a lawyer to something else. At that time in Singapore, relatively rare. Now it's not so rare. And that's a good thing, you know. People don't feel that it's a waste if you convert your career from being a lawyer or doctor to something else, yeah.
But it was still a deliberate choice for you. Like, for instance, you sold off your baby, Hotel 1929, and you were struggling with that a lot, right? Mm. Oh, where do I use this? How did you decide?
Yeah, so at the time, it was more emotional than difficult. I think it was emotional because it was my first baby, right?
Yeah.
But once I got over that, I reconciled myself to that. I realized, well, look, everything has a cycle, and you bring what you can to the table for that particular phase, and then let someone else take it over. So I'm a bit more phlegmatic about these decisions now. I don't agonize over them as much. I realize that just different phases. And can you repeat the success you had with that property? Because, you know, once a property goes through a certain cycle, you have to refresh it, right? And I never felt that I could do better than what I did originally. If I was going to renovate New Majestic, for example, and it was that phase when I'd have to make those decisions soon, I never felt that I had the right inspirations anymore. I did it once for that period very successfully. Can I repeat it? I didn't think I could. And I think there's many times when you realize that, okay, maybe my time doing that is over. But at the time when I first sold 1929, it was emotionally difficult.
Speaking of refreshing, and tomorrow I'll be speaking about this with another guest, Tai Ho, who founded Channel News Asia, is this idea of refreshing your career, the second act. So for him, it was very much media, setting up this TV broadcasting network, now writing books for people like George Hsu. Sounds like you're not going to think about a refresh. You're just going to keep doing what you've been doing.
I think I would like to find a third act, actually. I do. I don't know whether I will or anytime soon, but I kind of do feel like I might in the next 5-6 years. I would like to do something a little bit different. Not because I'm sick of doing this, I still have a lot of fun. But mainly because I think it would be nice to do something else again.
What might that be? if maybe someone listening would go, oh, I have that opportunity?
I don't know. I've done the restaurant thing, the hotel thing.
Museums. Maybe,
I think I would like to do something a little bit more on the creative side. I don't know, you know. I'd maybe like to manage an arts organization or something.
Your wife would be helpful there.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe do something more in education with children, something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think I wouldn't want necessarily to do something overtly corporate or money-making. Yeah.
Another question from Terence. What book are you reading now?
I just finished Shuggie Bain, which I loved. I like reading kind of fiction. I was reading a lot during pandemic, and I've slowed down now because I'm traveling like mad again. But I just finished Shuggie Bain, and I haven't started a new book. I literally just finished it last week. And I'm dreading starting on a new book because I know I'm traveling a lot towards the end of the year, and then I'll be carting this book around, reading one chapter, and then not reading it for like 3 or 4 weeks, and then starting a chapter again. I tend to go to the bookshop, buy like 5, 6 books at a time, and just leave it there, and then I work through it. But I probably will, because I'll be stuck on a plane, and then I'll be bored.
Yeah. Here's another question I'm going to play it for you.
Hey, Playing Low and Ling. I'm Helen Eber. I talk about HR leadership on LinkedIn and food on Instagram. My question is, how do you find the right talent for Unlisted Collection, and how important is it to you, thinking of Ivan and Rishi particularly, that on top of being able to cook delicious food, they have that additional artistic or intellectual curiosity?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is down to personal chemistry, you know. If I look at all the chefs that I work with, Chef Yong at Majestic, you know, Dave Pint, Rishi, all these guys, a lot of it is down to personal chemistry and a lot of trust. Because working on restaurants is difficult enough, right? You don't want to make it hard work. So a lot of the thing I find that makes me want to back a chef and have those long hours together, you got to get on well with them. There has to be a certain meeting of minds, a good chemistry, an easy relationship. You can't be questioning each other's intent or abilities. So I think for me, confidence in them.
Would you put in a non-compete clause?
Never. Mm. Yeah, I don't. I think for me, it's more, we work together long term. I make sure they get looked after.
Mm.
I mean, it's not non-compete, right? They have their employment contracts. They have their kind of shares in the company, things like that. They go off and do the artistic things, right? They fly off around the world, do all these chef events. I love them to do that. I don't try and restrict them. So long as they have in their mind that this restaurant that they have also needs to succeed. I don't track how many hours they do in the restaurant, things like that. So I respect their space, and I think it works. But yeah, the chemistry is important.
Final question from the audience. Let me play this one.
Hi, Peng Lo. This is Barbara. I'm a self-employed person, and I would love to know, on your busiest year, that was in 2010, what are the 3 key things you or your team attribute your success to, and that without these, you wouldn't have made it? And my second question is, what are the 3 key things already established in your business that made you survive COVID without any retrenchment? And also, quite impressive, only 1 business casualty. I'd really love to know, and I'm looking forward to your sharings and insights. Thanks.
Okay, that's 2 questions. Okay, 2010, I would say, look, at the time I was without a family, right? And I could devote all my time to work. So we were opening
6 altogether.
A lot of projects, you know, amongst them Wanderlust, Town Hall Hotel, and Shanghai's Waterhouse. And also in 3 hotels in 3 different countries. So I was on the road 24/7. I literally was never in Singapore. And I had the bandwidth to do it. I would never contemplate doing something like that again. But at the time, I had the bandwidth to do it. I had the energy to do it and the sheer bloody-mindedness to think I might make them succeed, right? So I think, yeah, in some ways, it was probably too ambitious. But I pulled it off because I was single. I had tons of energy, and I had no choice but to do it, right? Because I signed on to it, and I just had to make them work. But looking back, yeah, I don't think I would do it again. I certainly couldn't do it now because family and all that, right? I'd be divorced if I tried to do that the amount of work now. But at the time, yeah, I was living on an airplane. I was just in and out. I'd land and then take a shower and then take a flight there again. And you'd go through meetings after meetings. You were always in a different time zone. Very, very stressful because you were juggling budgets everywhere. Nobody had money in those days, right? You know, 2008, 2009. banks were not giving you money, and everything was seemed like it was going bust. Contractors were going bust. So it was a very risky environment, and consumers were not spending money. As I said, in a way, by 2010, when we reopened, the world economy was starting to lift up. So in some ways, we were lucky we were constructing in 08, 09. And when we opened, the economy was starting to boom, right? Whether it was China, Europe, all of it was starting to boom. So we were just lucky. But had I opened in 2008, let's see, I was doing, we would have been dead. Because we would have to pay off all those debts when the economy of the world shut down.
And what about the second question, the COVID and only one casualty?
I think largely we had a team that was prepared to knuckle down, right? And we were able to downscale our costs quickly enough. And a lot of it was heart and mouth moments. You know, we were calling all the hotels and making sure that we were able to shut down different wings. And what helped, of course, was we were only in developed markets. Ireland, UK, Australia, Singapore. Government support was pretty good. You know, if we were in Vietnam, Indonesia, all these places, they had no support. It would have been a different picture, I think. But we were in markets where we had significant support in terms of wage support, things like that. We had no income coming in, but we had those wage support. So we were able to contain our costs, and it was very, very painful, very, very stressful, but we managed to ride through most of it. And in fact, Jing shut down not necessarily as a consequence of COVID, but actually our lease right now at that time. So we were like, okay, do I want to renew the lease when there's no business? It was an opportunity for us to walk away, right? But our lease ran out just at the time when COVID was at its peak. So in some ways, we were lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a lot of luck that's involved all the time.
I tell you, people always think that they have so much to do with their own success. Often it's luck. Yeah. I realized over the years that, you know, you need as much luck as you need your own efforts to succeed. Often you look back, you're like, okay, you know, if I opened, as I said, in 08, we would have been dead in the water.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we were building in 08. It was painful, but it allowed us to boom when we opened in 2010.
A question for one of my favorite NPR podcasts, How I Built This. They always ask at the end, every guest, how much of your success will you attribute to luck versus hard work?
I would say it's at least 50%, minimum.
Yeah.
If not more, yeah.
Well, I always end my podcast with the same question. So the first is this. Do you feel like you have found your why?
I think I'm still searching. I have found it partially, for sure. But you know, I got asked this thing about whether I found my sort of raison d'etre, my métier, 10 years ago. And I kind of said no. And I said the same thing to you, right? I want to do something different in the last phase of my life. Not necessarily sort of business things, but I do feel I want to do something different. So maybe there's another component, because I don't want to feel like this age that I've done it all.
Yeah, a lot of people would say my seasons will always change. Yeah. So yes now, but it might change later.
Yeah, I do want it to change. I want to go to a different phase at some point.
Yeah.
But I think at early 50s, I don't feel that I've done it all. Yeah. Although I think I've done more than I ever thought I would, to be honest. When I first set out to work, I never imagined that I would be sitting here today talking to you about this. Yeah.
What kind of legacy do you want to leave behind?
People ask me this all the time. I don't actually want to leave any legacy. I want my family to love me and remember me, the people who knew me. That's the only legacy I want. Because I think a lot of things we do are ephemeral. Even the hotels we build, somebody in 10 years will come along and reimagine what we did. Mm-hmm. And rightly they should, right? Nothing is set in concrete, really. In 100 years' time, Lee Kuan Yew will be remembered for certain things, but the Singapore in 100 years will be very different from now. So his achievements will have got us a certain stage, and then after that, somebody else takes the mantle. That's how I feel. I don't really feel I want to leave a legacy. I want to be remembered by people who knew me well for good things. That's really the only legacy I want. I don't really feel that anything I do has any permanence, really, beyond getting us to the next stage, and then somebody else takes it on.
And what do you think are the most important qualities of a successful person?
I don't know. Not to get too big for your boots, I think. To always realize that in the grand scheme of things, even Bill Gates in the grand scheme of history is nothing more than a grain of sand. That's the reality. Elon Musk might seem like the giant of our age, but really in the grand scheme of things, he's also nothing, right? He's just going to be a little ripple on the surface, and then somebody else takes it on. And somebody will achieve more than him in the future. And that's what life is about. We only make an impact on the circle that's around us for the period of time that we're here.
And where can people go to find out more about what you're doing, support what you're doing as well?
Oof, I don't know. I don't think there's any resource that will tell people what I'm doing. Come and say hello to me and ask.
Well, they know what you're eating on your Instagram. Yes, I've been following.
Yes. Apart from that, I don't know. I often don't know what I'm going to do the next day. You know? Yeah, I have no idea.
Anything else you'd like to share that we haven't covered so far, Peng?
No.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure having you.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, you asked me a lot of questions. Tricky, I had to think hard.
Oh, yes. Are they different from your normal ones?
Yeah, I think you asked some fairly probing questions. You know, it made me think hard. Yeah, like my hardest failures and things like that, yeah. Those are always the most difficult ones. Because they're always painful, sometimes painful to realize how stupid you are, right? Yeah. In retrospect. Yeah.
But you don't seem to have an issue with sharing it, which is something that Asians tend to struggle with.
I think for me, you know, you learn more from your failures. People often say that, I realize it's correct. Sometimes you think you've had too many successes, as I said, you get a bit complacent. That's when you fall in that hole, right?
And that was the end of episode 140. The show notes can be found at sothismywhy.com/140. I want to give a special shout out to Linbei Studios for allowing us to film this while in Singapore. It is in person, so if you want to see the actual studio recording, you can just head over to YouTube. And if you yourself want to do some kind of recording as well in person, just head over to headmill.com/Linbei Studios for more information. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast, and see you next Sunday.